Good morning. Welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. Your panel is, to my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Sue Walker. I'm Leanne Dauphineau. We had three cases set for oral argument this morning, but the second case will not be arguing. We'll therefore begin with Meltzer versus McDonald et al. And then at the conclusion of that argument, we will recess briefly to allow the third case to argue. And since that's going to be a long argument and they have to set up, we'll take a recess while they do that. Daryl, did you have something you want to say?
I apologize, Your Honor. I just don't even know what time.
Let's see. They'll argue 35 minutes, and we'll recess 5 minutes to give y'all a chance to get your stuff up here and give us a chance to stretch our legs. No, that's okay. So don't go far if you leave. Okay, Deborah.
May it please the court, Mr. Fraley will argue for appellant, Mr. Kirk Pitter will argue for appellees.
May it please the court. Good morning. My name is Liz Fraley, and I represent Dr. Victor Meltzer, a nephrologist who was consulted to care for Mr. McDonald during his stay at Harris HEB Hospital. This case presents, shockingly enough, a new twist on Chapter 74 reports in that it presents a couple of novel factual situations. The first is whether a claimant at the trial court can admit judicially that his expert is not qualified on proximate cause and then turn around and at the Court of Appeals level argue that that same expert is indeed qualified to opine on proximate cause. And second, whether the report constitutes no report or a deficient report under the facts presented here. The medicine in this case is both interesting and integral to the issue of proximate cause. Walter McDonald came to Harris HEB Hospital where he was diagnosed with a type B aortic dissection. Essentially, the large artery that flows downward from the heart had dissected the interior lining from the outside lining, creating two different channels of blood. That tear inside the aorta terminated at the superior mesenteric artery, or SMA, the main artery that supplies blood to the gut. The aorta then continued to flow down to the kidneys, and Dr. Meltzer was consulted to assess the patient's renal function and whether that was having any impact on the patient's overall condition. A cardiothoracic surgeon, Dr. Carter, also a party here, evaluated and diagnosed the dissection. The patient died some days later of a necrotic small bowel. It is undisputed he did not die of kidney dysfunction. It is also undisputed that Dr. Meltzer was not consulted as a gastroenterologist, nor is he a gastroenterologist who would have been responsible for management of any small bowel issues. Now, appellees initially sued only Dr. Carter, the cardiothoracic surgeon, and provided a report from Dr. Fly, a cardiothoracic surgeon in St. Louis. Appellees later sued Dr. Meltzer and the hospital and provided two new reports, one from Dr. Carl Blond, a nephrologist who opined on standard of care and breach thereof, and then provided a supplemental report from Dr. Fly, the cardiothoracic surgeon, which contained a very interesting disclosure. It said that that report, together with the original report, were intended to express opinions on causation only as to Dr. Carter and the nurses and hospital at HEB. When we objected to the report and moved to dismiss, we specifically pointed out in footnote 1 that if the claimant intended that report to apply to Dr. Meltzer...
Wait, you pointed it out in the footnote?
Yes, Your Honor. When we objected and moved to dismiss, footnote 1, which is at the bottom of either page 1 or 2 of our objection, says the report contains this disclaimer that it is intended to apply only as to Dr. Carter and the hospital.
Why would you put that in a footnote?
I beg your pardon?
Never mind. I'm sorry.
All right. So appellees then responded and agreed, first of all, that Dr. Blonde was not qualified on the issue of proximate cause, and that his report, when read with the first report of Dr. Fly, constituted a good faith effort to comply with Chapter 74.
Okay, where are you getting that particular statement from? Because I have looked at the record in plaintiff's response to Meltzer's objections, and there's a specific paragraph that says, Dr. Blonde addresses that portion of the causation issue in his report by pointing out how Dr. Meltzer's negligent nephrology consultation, and then it goes on. So how, I'm not seeing how you're saying that they didn't assert that Dr. Blonde's report contained causation, a causation opinion, when it's in their response.
Well, I would direct the court to two different places. First, in the clerk's record at pages 106 to 107 and 115 to 116, and I would quote, there is no doubt that causation could not be sufficiently addressed by plaintiff's nephrology expert in this case involving surgical correction of a dissecting aorta. That is precisely why plaintiffs also obtained a report from a cardiothoracic cardiovascular surgeon.
Okay, and where are you getting that from?
It's in the clerk's record at 106 to 107 and 115 to 116, and it comes from the claimant's response to our objection and motion to dismiss. Then at oral argument, and I'm citing to the reporter's record at page 9, lines 2 through 9, the McDonald's counsel again argued that he had a surgeon to provide a causation report. And we quote that language both in our brief and in our reply brief because he was very, I apologize, in our reply brief because the claimant's expert and the claimant's attorney was very specific about the fact that they were not relying on Dr. Blonde for that testimony. Pardon me. And when you
look at the part that I quoted, what about the part where they specifically say on page 113 of the clerk's record that Dr. Blonde's report addresses that portion of causation issue in his report by pointing out, I mean, that's how I'm having a hard time seeing how they're judicially estopped or there's some kind of waiver when it's in writing that in a response that was filed with the trial court.
Well, and I think that that does cause a problem for them because while he contains some causal statements, which a nephrologist could do, he could say, well, from my perspective, you'd have to do this. I think the clearer and more unequivocal response when they say there is no doubt and we have retained a surgeon, quote, to provide a causation report, I mean, I think taken in its entirety, they are conceding that while Dr. Blonde looks at...
But doesn't a judicial omission have to be clear and absolutely unequivocal? And doesn't this written response at a minimum at least raise some equivocation?
Well, even if it raises equivocation, I think it then becomes a quasi-judicial admission because it is certainly an admission against interest. How could they take the position at the trial court when arguing to Judge Curry, look, we are not relying on Dr. Blonde for causation. We agree he is not qualified. I think at a minimum that is a quasi-judicial admission, even if you take it out of the judicial admission arena. But I think more than that, even if you look at what Dr. Blonde has to say about causation, let's set aside the whole issue of what they said or didn't say at the trial court and whether they can, in their brief now, jettison entirely Dr. Fly's report. They don't even mention its existence in their brief to this court. So if we break down what Dr. Blonde is and is not qualified to do, I think it still doesn't meet the Chapter 74 test. What he says...
I have another question related to that before we move on. What is the standard of review that we apply to the trial court's determination that the reports were adequate?
It's abuse of discretion, but based on the record that was at the trial court. And so I think you do have to look at what counsel said at the trial court level about the reliance on Dr. Fly's supplemental report and Dr. Blonde's qualifications.
All right, but my question is, if the standard of review is abuse of discretion, don't we have to affirm the trial court's ruling if it's correct on any ground?
Well, with due respect, I don't think so, and I think Methodist Hospital versus Steele looks at there are certainly times where portions of the trial court can be correct and portions need to be remanded. In this case, I don't think with due respect you ever get there, because Dr. Blond, even if we now accept him as the newly embraced causation expert for the claimant in this case, he still factually doesn't explain the causal link. And that's where I would go next and say, if I am mistaken about every other part of this case, and we then look to Dr. Blond's qualifications. I mean, when you look at the medicine of an aortic dissection, aortas take blood downstream from the heart to the body. The cause of death here was a clotting off or a dissection or a flap that killed the SMA. The level of dissection and the cause of death never reached the renal artery. And so how does Dr. Blond explain factually how a blockage up closer to the heart then was caused somehow by the kidneys? Literally, he would have blood clots swimming upstream, up the aorta, against every principle of law and science. Well, now, he doesn't put that. Yes,
he was also an internist, right?
He was. But with due respect, internal medicine doctors have to know that blood flows from the heart as well. And he would factually have to establish how the clot or the flap of dissection up here at the level of the SMA was caused by anything having to do with the kidneys. And when you look at his factual pattern, the only thing he says is, I think that kidney dysfunction was present. Then he says the SMA blockage caused the bowel to die, but he doesn't link how anything happening with the kidneys could have traveled upstream to cause the death of the SMA.
But it looks to me like from reading the reports that their theory is that the breaches of the standard of care in monitoring the kidney function delayed the surgery, and that if that had been reported more accurately, that then the surgery would have occurred more rapidly. So, and I think that the causation issue doesn't have to be, there can be multiple, even in expert reports, there can be multiple contributing causes.
There can, but there still has to be a causal link that ultimately ties what is happening with the kidneys to the surgery, and that link has to be made by a qualified expert. Dr. Blond is not, nor has he ever had, surgical privileges anywhere. He does not have privileges or qualifications on treatment of the SMA. He does not have privileges or qualifications to talk about when or whether surgery is indicated. Dr. Fly, the surgeon who has been designated and provided a report, never comments on that. And I think it's notable that neither in his first report nor the supplement nor to this day has a surgeon ever attributed a delay in the surgical outcome to anything that Dr. Meltzer did. Moreover, Dr. Blond is not qualified to opine on whether surgery in an aortic dissection could have been successful. He doesn't treat them. He's not allowed to treat them. And so even if he opines on, I think some delay applied to surgery and that shouldn't have happened, there's still that great missing link of, yes, but where's the surgeon who says, and we could have saved him, or surgery was indicated? That is the link that is still missing. And so when you look at Dr. Blond's report, even if we accept that he is now partially qualified, he never gives us that last surgical link. And I think in this case particularly, in the absence of a clear factual outline of medically how he thinks this is even possible, it was respectfully an abuse of discretion for the trial court not to sustain the objection as to his qualifications and not to dismiss the case, which now gets us into, I know, this court's favorite territory of no report versus insufficient report. And I acknowledge that in light of your recent opinions, I am now the one swimming upstream somewhat. But I think the Supreme Court has recognized that there is an area in which a report is so deficient that it is no report.
Excuse me, I'm sorry. If y'all are going to have a conference, would you please go outside? You're interrupting argument, and it's very difficult to hear her when y'all are talking. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's okay. I'm happy for the respite before I plow into this. there is a circumstance in which a report is no report, in which it is so deficient that it simply did not meet the criteria. And respectfully, from appellant's perspective, this may be that situation. Even if the claimant was equivocal at the trial court, both claiming qualification, no qualification, claiming we are relying on Dr. Blonde for causation or we are not, at the end of the day, what the trial court was told, and which I believe was said in good faith by claimant's counsel, is there is no doubt that a nephrologist, and I quote him, isn't qualified to talk about causation here. All of the portions of Dr. Fly's report that are contained in his original response to our motion to dismiss come from a report that was never served on Dr. Meltzer. And so this court is presented with a stipulation of there is no doubt that Dr. Blonde is not qualified, and then quotations from a report that wasn't served. And there is no discretion in the statute to rely on a report that wasn't served. And then a supplemental report that's on its face says it is intended to apply to only two of the healthcare providers, not Dr. Meltzer. And from a public policy perspective, one of the purposes of this report is to keep doctors like Dr. Meltzer, who should not have been included, from being included, but also to recognize when an expert appropriately limits the scope of his report to those individuals he truly believes to be culpable, this court should give deference to that type of restraint. Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, I have one. I just want to clarify it in my own mind that exactly what you're relying on for the quote that the plaintiff's attorney said Dr. Blonde was not qualified to opine on causation. Are you relying on the statements that are quoted on page 14 of your reply brief, that they said this is because causation such as this is more appropriately addressed by a surgeon rather than a nephrologist, and the other statement, no doubt causation could not be sufficiently addressed by plaintiff's nephrology expert? Are those the statements you're relying on?
In part, and then on the next page, 15 going into 16, part of the reporter's records where he discusses in front of Judge Curry his opinions about whether Dr. Blonde could or could not be. And if you look at the bottom of my page 15, starting on page 9, line 2, when an aortic dissection, something that only surgery can fix or deal with, causation, then you have a report from a nephrologist by standard of care, and then you have a surgeon provide a causation report. And the statute permits that and conceives of that. So both the written materials and his oral response at the hearing.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Anything else? All right, thank you.
May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Kirk Pittard. I'm here on behalf of the Appellees today, the McDonald's in this case. Your Honors, there is a significant disconnect in what has been presented at the trial court level and in the appellate courts in the briefing and argument with regard to what is the issue in this case. Dr. Blonde did not offer an opinion with regard to cause of death. And because he did not offer opinion as to cause of death, the issue is, did Dr. Blonde's opinion address causation regarding any other compensable injuries in this case? And when we look at Dr. Blonde's report, he addresses the standard of care with regard to a nephrologist. He addresses how Dr. Meltzer did not adhere to that standard of care as a nephrologist. And then he discusses the causation with regard to the breach of that standard of care. And in discussing causation, he discusses how Dr. Meltzer informed in this consultation with the surgeon that surgical intervention was not necessary at the time, and how that ultimately led to a renal infarct and led to a necrotic and moribund bowel. Now, we know renal infarct and a necrotic and moribund bowel are compensable injuries. I mean, people don't walk down the street with necrotic bowels. They don't walk down the street with renal infarcts. However, if someone does something to you that leads to a renal infarct or a necrotic bowel, that is a compensable injury. The pain and suffering associated with those conditions are compensable injuries in this case. And this case is not only a wrongful death case, but it's a survival action. So those conditions prior to death and the pain and suffering associated with those conditions are injuries for which the plaintiffs are seeking compensation. Dr. Blum's report sufficiently addresses causation with regard to those conditions. And because his report sufficiently addresses causation with regard to those conditions, he satisfies the two elements of a Chapter 74 report. He provides Dr. Melter sufficient information to inform him of the actions or inactions that the plaintiffs are complaining about, and he provides the trial court with sufficient information to determine whether or not the plaintiff's claim has sufficient merit to even get to the courthouse. Now, there's this entire issue with regard to whether there was a judicial admission that Dr. Blum could not opine as to causation. And it's invalid for two different reasons. First of all, even if there was some type of judicial admission that Dr. Blum could not address causation as to death, there's been no comments at all, unequivocal or otherwise, whether Dr. Blum could opine as to causation for a renal infarct and necrotic and moribund bowel. There's been no comments at all related to that. Now, secondly, if we get into the elements of a judicial admission, we know that a judicial admission must be a statement in the course of a judicial proceeding contrary to an essential fact in the case that's deliberate, clear, and unequivocal, and giving conclusive effect would be consistent with public policy. As the Supreme Court has said in the Hennigan case, a judicial admission is a formal waiver of proof that relieves the opposing party of the burden of proving the admitted fact. Now, that definition is important because when we're talking about a formal waiver of proof, relieving a party of having to offer evidence, we're talking about essential facts, ultimate issues of facts to be resolved by a jury. Because you don't offer evidence on facts that aren't essential. You don't offer evidence on things that aren't going to be considered by a jury and ultimately determined by a jury. Now, in this case, any comments with regard to Dr. Blum's ability to opine as to one causation or another doesn't at all concern an essential ultimate fact that's going to be determined by a jury. These reports and any comments related to them actually can't even be used in a trial. It can't be offered as evidence, can't be used in cross-examination, can't be used in a deposition. And that's under Chapter 74. It is solely limited to this initial determination that the legislature has set up that a plaintiff must get over this hurdle in order to convince the court that their claims have merit. That's the sole purpose of these reports. So any comments related to these reports and the opinions in them don't have anything to do with an essential fact, an ultimate fact that will ultimately be determined by a jury, and therefore it's not a judicial admission. Secondly, even if there was any kind of statement regarding Dr. Blum's ability to opine or not opine as to cause of death, there has not been a deliberate, clear, and unequivocal statement that Dr. Blum cannot address causation as to renal infarction and necrotic and moribund bowel. Therefore, it's not a judicial admission. Lastly, with regard to the elements of judicial admission, would it be consistent with public policy to give conclusive effect to any statements with regard to Dr. Blum's ability as to opine as to cause of death? The public policy with regard to these reports are twofold. One, provide the defendant with sufficient information so that they know the actions or inactions that are being complained about. Second, provide the trial court an opportunity to make an initial determination about whether the plaintiff's claim has merit. Now, would it be consistent with public policy to say, here is the expert report, and the trial court is bound to look at the four corners of the report, yet there's certain causation language in here that the trial court should ignore? Is that consistent with the public policy of informing the defendant of the actions and inactions that the plaintiff is complaining about, and to give the trial court an opportunity to determine whether the plaintiff's claim has sufficient merit to even get to the courtroom. No, it doesn't support that public policy. Therefore, once again, this is not a judicial admission. Now, in our appellee's brief, we were very clear to set forth the fact that Dr. Blum's report addressed causation as to a compensable injury, numerous compensable injuries, one being a renal infarct, moribund bowel, and necrotic bowel. Now, I think it's telling that in the appellant's reply brief, in the oral argument, in the trial court, not one time did they ever challenge Dr. Blum's ability to offer an opinion as to those three conditions. Over and over again in their briefs, they say Dr. Blum is not qualified to offer an opinion as to cause of death. He's not qualified to offer an opinion as to cause of death. But not one time did they ever address his ability to offer an opinion as to these other compensable injuries that are being sought in this case.
I have a question.
Your Honor.
Is the failure to serve Dr. Fly's first report then, in your mind, just a non-issue?
Actually, yes. We didn't even address Dr. Fly's report because Dr. Fly's it doesn't have anything to do with this case. It doesn't have anything to do with this appeal. The reason they continue to focus on Dr. Fly's report is because it was offered related to causation of cause of death. And in this appeal, what we're arguing, we're not dealing with causation as to cause of death. We're dealing with causation as to these compensable injuries that Mr. McDonald suffered before he ever died. And because we have an opinion as to those conditions, then we have a sufficient report to get us past this initial hurdle under Chapter 74. The bottom line in this case is that the plaintiff in this case did not judicially admit that Dr. Blum was not qualified to offer an opinion as to the renal infarction, the necrotic and moribund bowel. And because those are compensable injuries, his report was sufficient to support causation by addressing not only standard of care, Dr. Meltzer's breach of that standard of care, but how Dr. Meltzer's breach resulted in causing those particular injuries. One thing I would add, Justice Walker, you were talking a while ago about the causal connection between the renal infarct and the moribund bowel. And the point you made was correct. Dr. Blum was not suggesting in his report that the renal infarct caused the moribund bowel. That's not what he was suggesting. What he was saying was that because of the renal infarct, that if Dr. Meltzer had addressed that as soon as he should have, and if he had recommended in his consult with the surgeon that surgical intervention needs to take place now, when the surgical intervention would, if its surgical intervention would have taken place then, they would have found renal infarct, they would have found these problems with the bowel, and in his report, he mentioned that that likely would have prevented those conditions from progressing the way they did. Unless the court has any questions of me, I'll yield back the balance of my time.
Questions? Thank you. Is there a rebuttal?
And I'll wave back in with the court's permission.
All right.
Counsel creates an interesting conundrum for the court. This is a wrongful death case. It is not merely a survival case. And I think he has conceded that there is not an expert, as to Dr. Meltzer, on any of the wrongful death claims. And under Methodist versus Steele, that part should be reversed and rendered or remanded to the court for assessment of the fees as to the wrongful death claimants. My understanding is they now limit their claims of an adequate report to the survival claims with two specific injuries, the renal infarct and the moribund and necrotic bowel. I would point the court to Dr. Blum's initial report on the second and third pages, where he describes the renal infarct as a pre-existing condition, one which was caused by the initial dissection. And so we have no factual explanation that that renal infarct in any way changed, evolved, or worsened due to any act or omission alleged by Dr. Meltzer. He does not factually distinguish that it preexisted Dr. Meltzer even forming a physician-patient relationship. Then we get to the necrotic and moribund bowel, which we now know things don't swim upstream, so we don't have an explanation for how any kidney issue caused that. And that gets us back to, is a nephrologist qualified to opine on the causes and the ability surgically to intervene to avert a necrotic and moribund small bowel when he does not lay out the factual set of circumstances that led to that condition? Was it an immediate flash infarct? Did it evolve over days? Does that make a difference in whether a surgeon can or cannot fix it? His report is silent as to that, and with due respect to Dr. Bond, he isn't qualified to opine on that. And I think this focuses down the issues again. There's no expert as to wrongful death. There's no factual link as to the preexisting renal infarct, and he is not qualified on the necrotic and moribund small bowel. Finally, from a public policy perspective, if we're looking at that, I think that counsel for a claimant has the ability and argument before the court to disavow or to opine that one of his experts may be stepping beyond the bounds, which he as an attorney believes would be appropriate in the constraints of Chapter 74. I believe that's probably what happened here, but that does not dismiss the fact that the statements were made and that it would be appropriate in this case to remand to the trial court only for assessment of statutory attorney's fees and render as to the rest. With no questions, I'll give you back my time.
Questions? Thank you. Case is submitted. We appreciate your argument. It's been very helpful. Thank you for being here today. And you are excused if you would like to go about your business. If you want to stay and hear the next argument, you are certainly welcome to do that too. But we're going to be in recess for about 5 minutes.
All right.